think we are firing on all cylinders here. So,
yep.
Awesome. Well, yeah, our podcast is really casual. So we just kind of get into it. We don't have any like intro or sponsors. We just fly by the seat of our pants here at Ember Map. So,
all right, let's do this.
So, yeah, Mike Perm, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on. You know, we both have been longtime admirers of yours and have benefited greatly from your tech over the years. So it's kind of exciting to have you here and to talk about what you're working on these days.
I really appreciate you both having me on.
Awesome. So, yeah, for folks not familiar with your work, today we're going to be talking about this JavaScript library you're working on called Factory, but this is definitely not your first open source project. So maybe a good place to start would just be to talk about Factory, and that's Factory spelled with a K in case you want to Google that. We'll also include some links in the show. But why don't you just start by giving kind of an overview of what Factory is?
Sure, of course. So my previous big open source project is called Sidekick, and it's misspelled, of course, to make it easy to Google. And so, of course, I misspelled Factory, also F-A-K-T-O-R-Y.
But that's a great little trick, by the way.
I highly recommend it, as opposed to like Chef or some other open source project that's just impossible to Google for. To get back to the matter at hand, Factory is a background job system, which is programming language independent. So you can use it from any programming language. And so my previous project, Sidekick, is Ruby only. So really only Rails and Ruby business applications can sort of leverage it and use all of its features. Whereas Factory has a different design and is usable from any sort of any language, from Ruby, of course, and Factory itself is written in Go, so of course there's a Go API. But I also have Node and JavaScript integration, Python, PHP, Elixir, and you know, so I cover most of the big business programming languages these days.
Very cool. If I was just like a web app developer and I make CRUD apps and I hadn't encountered a need for queuing yet, what would be kind of like maybe the simplest first way that I might encounter that need and what this library helps me solve?
So background jobs are really useful when you want to do work out of the context of the user making a request and response. So, you know, if you're responding to a browser request, then that's fine. You're using your web application server and you're rendering the page dynamically, either on the server side or client side. However, if you're trying to process maybe thousands or millions of things, let's say overnight in batch, or just you want to process a million things, you can create those as background jobs and they'll all run as sort of independent business transactions, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And Sidekick and or Factory will be the management interface and the system that will run all of those transactions for you. And they'll do it typically concurrently, you know, at massive scale if necessary. So, you know, my systems typically can handle thousands of jobs per second. So they'll scale pretty far to pretty much any business aside from the largest scale internet businesses.
It's very, very cool and very impressive. What are some of the things that like I might be doing in that request response cycle that maybe I've like never used a job queue? Like what are some things that the first few things I should move out?
That's a great question. Yeah, because that's typically how people get involved in background jobs is the more complex your response is, the more you might want to break out some of that work into background jobs. Typically, you'll use background jobs to do any sort of network call to another party. So you want to send an email. Let's say someone presses submit to join your website to create an account. You're going to create the user and any sort of account data in your database as a transaction. But typically, you'll also send an email. Maybe you'll create a record in some sort of third-party service, and you may contact other accounting systems, ERP systems, who knows. But all of that service interaction is brittle. It can fail a lot of the time. You know, you've got SLAs with all these different third-party services, and you know, if you've got a dozen different services that, even though they may each promise three nines, when you're talking about using a dozen different services, that means that more often than not, you're going to see failures once a day, once or twice or three times a week. So dealing with that kind of brittleness is part of the value that a background job framework brings. So creating background jobs is typically much faster than making those service calls. So, you know, when that user presses that submit button to create an account, you create a dozen background jobs and then immediately return to the user. And that it may only take, a few milliseconds as opposed to many seconds to do. So the user experience is much better. But as I was saying, once you create these background jobs, they all execute independently. And so they can all fail or succeed independently. And so this way, if one service is down, it's not going to affect whether you're calling the other services or not.
I think it's really interesting, just to give you a little context, like I'm coming from more of a front-end focus, like in my kind of career as a programmer. Ryan kind of came from more of a back-end and, well, full stack, and then has recently been focused on front-end. But Ryan has more experience like doing Rails and using Sidekick. For me, it's always been like not as much my responsibility, but I think the interesting thing here about what you're saying and tying it to folks in our audience who are more focused on the front end and maybe haven't had to like implement a job queue in a back end server is that you can see very quickly like how this has a direct impact on the UI and the UX that you're building. And as JavaScript developers, we're working with concurrency all the time. I mean, the browser, the JavaScript runtime in the browser is a concurrent environment, and things are happening, concurrently. There's a request going out with a loading spinner on a button, but the user can still click a back link to navigate to the homepage. And you have to think about all those things together. And so the idea, I think it's important, one of the important things of what you're talking about for front-end developers to maybe understand a little bit of how the sausage gets made is that we are living in a world with more services and the way the brittleness basically comes together is that you're building a front end and you don't want the user to just sit there and wait for 10 things to happen. And so now you kind of are seeing why. It's because all of these things are going out. So what's critical that we basically want to, you know, hold the user in spot in one place and until we move on to something? And what is like an email where that's really a new UI state? Basically what you're saying is if you were to pull something out that's expensive operation, like sending an email, you know, maybe charging a Stripe subscription, maybe processing an image, things that are kind of expensive and brittle, which is just kind of the certain class of services you interact with, instead of just having two states in your UI representing kind of before and after, now you can have more. And it's a good thing from the perspective of the front-end developer who now gets more control over the user experience and can tell them your account was created, but now you expect an email to come in the next few seconds or something like that. Is that kind of the right angle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I oftentimes think of that modern applications are getting more and more services, network services integrated into them. And the more services you integrate, the more brittle your application itself becomes. And so it becomes more important than ever to sort of break out that communication between that third party into something like a background job so that it can be monitored, so that it can managed and debugged if there's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, it's kind of like, just instead of clicking save and then waiting the whole time and you have two pieces of React state, which is like has saved is false and then true. And then your product manager is like, we need a loading spinner here to let the user know that something's happening. So now you have like a pending state that you've added, and then now your UI has three states. It's kind of the way I'm thinking about it, where every time we add a background job, now we have this new kind of path through our application. And it's kind of like why this architecture is important for front-end developers to understand at least a little bit, even if they're not the ones implementing it.
Well, and it's important to understand that if you do have a lot of those services integrated into that call, and when the user's waiting, that it's far more likely to fail, and then the user doesn't understand what went wrong, and now you've got to build in explanations to the user as to, oh, this failed, oh no, this failed, oh no, this third thing failed. And if you break it into background jobs, the user doesn't really care anymore. You can treat them
as first class states of your application, basically.
Well, as long as the database save works, you just go on, and then in the background, you'll process that image. You'll sync their user record to another third party system, because the user doesn't care about that, and it's not critical for it to succeed immediately. Mm-hmm. For that user's account to be active, right?
Right.
It's a sort of a best effort thing. And then if it fails, the developer, the back-end developer, can go into the user interface and see, oh, here's the backtrace associated with the error as to why this failed. And they can fix the bug, or the background job will automatically retry typically. And so if their system was down and it comes back up an hour later, then an hour from now that job will succeed. And the user just never knew anything wrong. Anything went wrong.
That's a really, really great point, because in UI development, we have this concept of optimistic updates. So you're submitting a form, and often because we have all this code on the client, we can just show you like the thank you page before we even get a AJAX response back from the server, especially for things that we expect to succeed, or if they do fail, we can retry them. And so it's like background jobs are a way to think about this, where it's, it's a great pattern in the UI
example,
optimistic updates.
The example I typically give is something like a place order button, where the place order is absurdly complex under the covers. Typically, I mean, it's a real iceberg. To the user, they put in their information, they hit place order. But typically, you've got a dozen different calls to accounting systems, to ERP systems, to warehouse and inventory systems. All that stuff can be brittle, and the user doesn't care. They just want to know that their order was placed in the database, and now that database entry for that order can be synchronized to all these different systems through background jobs. And it just makes your system more robust.
More robust, and also fewer UI states to even show the user. And the fact that you can retry it, and I'm guessing, you know, it sounds like Factory has some of this built in where it retries things that have failed. You don't even have to account for that in the front end. And so that's kind of a nice way to sidestep the whole problem of, oh, we have three or four states we have to design and account for. Actually, what if we just moved the non-critical stuff off? As long as we have a record for it in our background job queue, then we can just tell the user it's fine. And in the exceptional cases where a background fix doesn't work, you know, maybe we just email them or we deal with it then. But for the 99% case, or maybe all the times, it basically ends up working.
Exactly.
It's really cool. So I know, you know, a little bit about Sidekick's history and why you made it in the first place. When you made Sidekick during the Rails era, the height of the Rails era, I guess I should say, what was the main motivation there? Were there alternatives? What led you to kind of taking this problem space on in the first place?
Yeah, so I have been an open source developer for 20 years now. I first wrote... my first substantial piece of open source code was a Napster clone. If you remember the music downloading service, Napster, pretty easy going with the copyrights there, but simpler times, exactly. It was a fun project to take on, but I wrote a version of Napster in Java, and it was all open source and released on SourceForge. Which, you know, dates me pretty heavily, I think. But GitHub came along, Twitter came along, I moved on to Ruby on Rails. And for all the Rails startups that I was working at, we always needed sort of a background job system for all the reasons that we've sort of been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I found myself reinventing the wheel over and over. Not only that, but the background job systems that had sort of been developed by the community The two biggest ones were called Delayed Job and Rescue. And neither of them were multi-threaded. They were both single-threaded, and so they were quite slow and required a ton of memory. So I wanted to build a multi-threaded sort of concurrent background job system. And at the time, everybody freaked out and said, you know, Ruby and Rails is not thread safe and it's impossible. This will be impossible to do. But it turns out once you gave people a compelling reason, they sort of cleaned up their act within about a year or two. And after a year or two, there's really no more discussion about thread safety. But anyways, that's where Sidekick's performance comes from, is because it spins up 10 threads. It can execute 10 threads or 10 jobs concurrently. And so it gets much higher performance than Delayed Job and Rescue. So Sidekick, over the next 5 years after I released it, really went from nowhere to being the big background job framework. And so now it's the leading sort of choice for anybody building a Ruby and Rails app these days. And then Factory, I created, I think about 2.5 years ago. And Factory came from a position of me recognizing that Sidekick was limited to the Ruby community. And it was extremely popular and everybody seemed to love it. And I thought, why don't I bring some of this Sidekick magic to the greater computing community? And sort of, you know, why don't I build it for JavaScript and for Python and for PHP? And so I briefly toyed with the idea of building one specific to each language, but then I realized that would be a lot of work, and I'd have to be an idiomatic programmer in each of those languages, and that's just impossible. You
tall order.
You cannot be idiomatic and be fixing bugs daily for you know, a dozen different languages and a dozen different builds of the same sort of package.
Right.
So instead, what I decided to do was sort of re-architect Sidekick so that it could be used from any language, and what that involved was me building my own sort of server, job server. With Sidekick, Redis is the main server that runs, and then Sidekick is a worker package that talks directly to Redis. And with Factory, you have a server that you run 24/7, and then there are worker packages written for each language that can leverage the features that are built into the Factory server. So, what that means is the worker package for each language becomes much simpler than what Sidekick is.
Okay, so go ahead, Ryan.
And does this mean that like the Factory server is the one that can handle all the, like, I need to retry something or something failed here, and then is that what you mean by the workers are simpler? Because the workers just focus on...
All the worker is doing is pulling a job off of a queue and then either acknowledging it or failing it if it succeeds or fails. And so it doesn't have to worry about retries. It doesn't have to worry about a web interface. All that kind of infrastructure is built into the server itself. And that's all written in Go.
So just to recap to make sure I understand, basically, going back to Sidekick, for folks who don't know, Redis is like a memory-based storage that's very fast. And so kind of going back to your discussion of the motivation for a background job system and what architecture you want to be able to create jobs very quickly. So that's within the transaction, happens within a transaction of a request response cycle. And then the job itself can pull from that queue and take as long as it needs to. But that's why you use something like Redis with Sidekick for the creation of jobs. Is that correct?
Right. Redis is great as a scratch space. It has constant order queue operations. So that's a computer science term, but you know, order one, push and pop from a queue or a list structure. So it has a lot of these data structures that become very useful for implementing functionality. And so, you know, you have databases like Postgres that sort of have queue operations built into them also. But I typically think of Redis as being more designed for high-performance queues and less Postgres, because a background job is sort of an ephemeral thing. Mm-hmm. If you're processing thousands of them per second, you're not going to persist them into your database and then delete them. there becomes trade-offs there if you're trying to implement the queue in Postgres. So,
got you.
Anyways, Redis is flexible, has lots of different data structures where I can implement functionality on top of, and it's simple enough and widespread enough to where people typically don't question the need for it.
Right. And then so bringing that architecture to Factory, you're saying basically the packages that are specific to the language, their responsibility is this, is the creation of jobs, which is why they're basically just sending messages to the server to create a job.
There's a very small set of commands that the Factory server implements, and the workers just call those commands. So things
got
like
you.
Push this job, pop a job off, acknowledge this job, fail this job. It's really just comes down to about maybe 10 verbs that you're talking about.
Cool.
Push, pop, fetch, acknowledge, fail, that sort of thing.
And then so let's say we're using Factory with JavaScript. And so here, again, we're talking about server code, right? So this would be like a Node server that's running. And we have lots of emails to send or images to process. And basically from this perspective of our Node server, we're able to use the package, what do you call each particular language?
A worker package.
The worker package. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be like an NPM package, Factory worker, it looks like. And then I can just, create jobs as often as if tons of people are signing up and they all need emails. I can just call that API directly from that package, but I don't have to worry about all spawning concurrent workers, making sure things, that is all just abstracted away from me. And that's basically behind this server.
Not quite. The worker concurrency is totally up to your worker package and your environment. Mm. So if your worker code is not thread safe, there's no reason why you can't just use a single thread or, whatever the equivalent is in Node, just a single concurrency. And just process one job at a time. That's totally up to you and your application. If your code is thread safe, though, you can obviously Python, Ruby, sort of thread-oriented languages. Mm-hmm. You can spawn 10, 15, 20 threads in each process and process all these jobs in parallel.
Gotcha.
So nothing stopping you. That's out of the boundaries of Factory.
Right.
That's up to your application code is what runs in the worker package. And so it's up to your application and that worker package to define how concurrent it wants to run.
Got you.
What does that look like? Would I have would I configure my worker to like run four threads, or would I be responsible for doing like thread.new? Job.pull.
No. The for instance, the Factory Worker Ruby package just gives you a command line argument that says, please use in threads to execute cool. jobs. And it'll spawn, by default, I think it's 10. So it'll spawn 10 threads and just pull off jobs concurrently. And so you'll get some nice parallelism there and process jobs pretty quickly because of it. And then, of course, you can run as many processes as you want. So you might have five processes, each process having 10 threads. Now you're processing 50 jobs in parallel. So cool. Again, that's up to you and how many resources you want to devote, how many cores and machines and all that kind of stuff. But like I said, Factory will scale up to thousands of jobs per second. So, you know, you could potentially create hundreds or even thousands of threads to execute jobs that are all pulling from one Factory server.
Mm, cool. So is that a reason why you wanted to use Go to implement the server?
Well, that's a good question. So why did I pick Go for Factory? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of reasons. It's the easiest modern language to deploy because you build Go binaries, have no runtime dependencies at all, except for the kernel on Linux. So it doesn't care if it's running on glibc, it doesn't care if it's running on Alpine, it doesn't pull in any sort of shared libraries. So it's really, what I can do is I can build a single binary that can run on any distribution of 64-bit Linux. And that is impossible to do in C and C++, for instance. You have to build binaries that are specific to Ubuntu, specific to Red Hat, specific to Fedora. It's really ugly. So Go makes the distribution and deployment far, far easier. It also has pretty nice tooling. It's a very simple language, so it's easy to read. And it took me about 3 or 4 months to come up to speed on it and get really comfortable with its idioms. But once I did, I found it to be a pleasure to program in.
Very cool. Now is the plan, I don't know, was there ever a plan for like Sidekick to actually just use Factory under the hood?
To me, they're different enough where I don't want to rock the boat there. Sidekick ecosystem is solid, it's stable, it's reliable, and I want it to be 100% compatible where possible. So yeah. I have no desire to sort of pull the rug out from under everybody and switch to a completely different technology. No, I think the way I'm sort of marketing Factory and the communities I'm going for are those who are more focused on polyglot. So if you maybe are a Rails community and you know my work, but then you want to start working in Elixir, or maybe you want to bring in a little Python because of some numerical computing, and maybe now you need to integrate with some sort of PHP system, you can use Factory to implement jobs in all those languages. So again, if you have some sort of custom library or custom code written in a particular language, you can now execute that directly from a Factory job.
Got you.
Cool. On that, what is like the typical architecture of sort of like you have these web servers and you have the Factory server, then you have your worker servers. Do you recommend like one Factory server that all your different languages talk to?
Yeah, I mean, I typically recommend one Factory server per application. So what you'd say in Ruby is a monorail, like one mono repo, or one sort of thing that's deployed. You'll have a Factory server to deal with all the background jobs coming from that application. And then typically an application is maintained by one team. So if you have some other team over on the other side of the building, they're going to have their own application. They might have their own Factory instance because you want them to be managed separately, right? Each team needs to sort of be standalone and have their own infrastructure that they can manage. So that's sort of what I would recommend there.
Okay. Interesting. Cool. Cause we have, we use Node and Rails, and we have a bull server and a Sidekick. And so if we were going to switch to Factory, you would still see us having like two Factory servers for each of those, for like our
well, I mean, if they're conceptually one application maintained by one team, then I don't see any reason why you wouldn't also have one Factory server. Okay. You would typically have queues that are specific to your language. So for your existing bull jobs, you might have a JS queue that the JavaScript worker packages would pull jobs from that queue. And so that way, you sort of segment your jobs based on which language they should target, whether they should go to the Ruby workers or go to the JavaScript workers.
Gotcha. Another question I have is I know in like Rails, when we set up these jobs, we typically have, it's like the same application on both the thing that enqueues a job as well as the thing that runs a job, even though they're different code paths. So like the it's the Rails app that's serving the web requests, and then the jobs also live in the Rails app.
Yep.
Does that make sense? You know, the monorail type.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Do you recommend sort of that approach with other languages, or do you see like workers being specific worker applications? How do you think about this?
I don't want to. I fall on the side of sort of keep it simple where possible. And so I'm a big fan of monorepos. I'm a big fan of monolithic apps. You can think of these different processes executing things as, I just lost my train of thought.
Happens to us all the time.
Exactly. You can think of them as sort of logical entities, but they're all running as part of one physical app code base, right? Mm-hmm. They're all trying to achieve
one thing. They're not
one thing, which is executing business, right? So, right. So that's why Sidekick, for instance, has its client API and its worker APIs all in one sort of gem package, and then it's up to, and then sort of at runtime, your code can sort of figure out is it running as a client and pushing jobs, or is it running as a worker and executing jobs. But it's all sort of, both APIs are in the same sort of code base. I don't sort of physically split them off. And I've done the same thing with Factory. The Factory has a client package, which is all of its client APIs that will, can create push jobs. But that client package is in the Factory repo also. So, gotcha. Yeah, it can be a little bit of a stumbling point, but it just takes some time to sort of understand the architecture of how things work.
Nice.
Yeah, I was going to say it looks like it's the same for the Factory Worker NPM package here, where you have connect and .job methods and then also register and work methods, the worker side, right, of the APIs on the same package. So
right. Yeah, I mean, no matter what language you're in, you're either going to be on one side pushing jobs into Factory, or on the other side pulling jobs out of Factory.
Right. Cool. What's, like, you've been working on background job systems now for years. What's, like, one of the most interesting things that you've learned? Like, if you were dropped in a desert island with a computer and no internet and had to write a new background job system, what's one of the things that you know now, having done all this work on it, that you would make sure to pay attention to as you were building this thing? Because I read some of your old blog posts, and I remember you were talking about some of the, just some of the architectural changes that Sidekick had gone through over the years. Yeah. And maybe it's still just concurrency.
I mean, I think the funny thing is, given that I have a business around this stuff, I've been able to work on it for, 8 years now. And because I have the luxury of all that time, I have been able to shepherd the projects to go in the direction where they are at a point where I think that they're
most suitably designed, basically.
Damn fine engineering is I guess yeah. What I get to. I mean, where if you want to do something differently, you're going to want to sort of completely rethink how you do things.
Yeah.
I think the big thing, the big onrushing wall toward us all is things like serverless and Lambda. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. that's where if you design your application to use background jobs and have these sort of fine-grained business transactions, how does that look if you migrate that to Lambda? And is that good? Is that bad? What are the trade-offs there? Right. So that's kind of the direction I'm looking right now, is I'm trying to figure out how does a world full of Lambda and other serverless APIs, how can I bring background jobs to that, and what sort of APIs and infrastructure do business applications need to be built on top of those sorts of serverless platforms? Mm-hmm. So I think Sidekick and Factory as it stands are great as infrastructure that you own and that you deploy,
right,
and you manage yourself. But if we did want to go to a direction where we don't want to do any sort of management ourselves, and we just want to use the AWS managed Lambda or something like that, what would I need to provide to get onto that sort of platform?
Have you ever thought about running factory as a service?
I did. I considered it briefly. What I decided is that my strength and expertise is in software development and providing the features. My strength is not in 24/7 DevOps and trying to support different cloud providers and different data centers and, you know, all the things that come with that. I really just didn't want to get bogged down into becoming an AWS expert like every other SaaS out there. So I said this when I first released Factory. I said, I don't have any plans to build a SaaS around this. I know that's the first question people are going to ask, and I welcome other people. If they want to build a company that provides Factory as a SaaS, you are more than welcome to, with my blessing, to do that. And the only commercial sort of negotiation might be if you want to license the Factory Pro and Factory Enterprise.
Features.
Levels. Yeah. Step ups to provide them to your customers. So you could provide Factory Enterprise as a SaaS. That would be where we would have to have some sort of negotiation and contract. But, right. But yeah, I don't have a problem with people providing Factory as a SaaS. I would welcome that, and that would enrich the environment for sure.
Right. Ron, do you have a question?
Well, back to the Lambda thing, like that's, I'm super interested to hear more of your thoughts. Like, my brain was kind of going where Sam was going, where like a Factory as a SaaS thing. But if, let's say that doesn't exist because you don't want to make it, how do you see job queuing working in a serverless world?
Yeah, so the issue with serverless is that it's stateless, right? I mean, you're effectively, it's, Lambda's really good for responding to events where the event is some sort of JSON blob and you can just do something based on that event. But it's not good when you're talking about a stateful database sort of oriented business application, because otherwise you can have a sort of a, what is it, RDB? Is that the Amazon service for databases, RDB?
Yeah, RDS, RDB.
RDS, yeah, or a Heroku database, whatever you might have. You would need to have that database and either self-manage it or have AWS or Heroku manage it. And then your Lambda functions would have to connect to the database, take that data that they have as part of their payload, do something in the database, and then shut down. And really the cold start problem with Lambda and even the warm start presents enough overhead to where any business that's going to pay money for a commercial version like what I provide, they're probably going to be okay with running workers 24/7 so that they can respond within microseconds rather than having this sort of 100 millisecond startup and you know, up and down kind of thing. So Lambda is not perfect. Really the big question is, how do you integrate state into these Lambda handlers? And so if you have a background job, you know, what does your client push to, and then how does Lambda get informed of it? So I know you can push to SQS, and then SQS can actually spin off a Lambda handler, I believe. So at that point, if you also have an RDS, then that really starts to look like a background job system, and it's just no one's actually built that yet. And my stopping point is really that I like to build open source technology that are built on top of sort of open systems, you know. So Sidekick and Factory are built on top of Redis and other open source technologies. If I were to build a background just system on top of Lambda, that's a closed source system that is vendor specific. So you're locking yourself into Amazon by sort of buying my technology or using my technology.
So I guess a counterpoint is, who hasn't locked themselves into Amazon these days? But I think the point is taken.
Yeah. Well, I don't use Amazon at all. I don't use Heroku at all. I
Oh, really?
I beat the drum of reducing your dependencies severely, and to make things as simple as possible and as reliable as possible. And so the only thing I have is a DigitalOcean droplet as a server, and then I can rebuild my server with a bash script. So I try to keep things very simple.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I'm at a point in my life where I hope to never write a bash script again. So it's just different strokes. But I mean, even still, it kind of sounds like you maybe haven't managed to avoid your fate of learning AWS, because you were listing off all these services, and it sounds like you're going to have to understand it, you know, maybe just as much as if you had started a SaaS on AWS.
Yeah, I mean, the
services are so complicated, you know, there's so much going on.
Well, and so many companies are on AWS now that it's hard to ignore it at this point. It's almost like table stakes that you need to support AWS in some guise. Right now, Factory, I built in support for Docker into Factory, so I now ship it as a Docker container, and I provide a Docker repository for the commercial versions, so that you can simply pull a commercial image from my Docker repository. Cool. So that was one small step toward supporting, you know, commercial systems. But AWS is going to be a whole nother world if I elect to do that.
Right. Godspeed. Well, changing direction a little bit, I think something that would also be interesting for our audience is kind of some of your perspectives on open source sustainability. And, you know, you mentioned that you have, you know, a business, and that you've been able to basically work on Sidekick kind of full time for, you know, years at this point. And, you know, some folks might think, oh, right, so you believe in open source, and this is an open source project that I can use for free, and it's probably the same as every other open source project that I use, but it's actually not. So you have a lot of writing and other podcast interviews on the internet that folks can find to hear more about the story. But basically, you have found a way to sustain your work on Sidekick, now in Factory, on all these open source projects, which you really believe in, through kind of commercial offerings. So, I don't even know where to start, but I'm just super interested in this topic, you know, having worked in open source for a couple of years now and seen the patterns, you know?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, there wasn't a question there, but I think we all sort of get the feeling of the question, which is, you know, why did I do this? And, is this right for me and my project? And the answer is that, as I mentioned, I've been an open source developer for like 20 years now. And I did spend 3 or 4 years maintaining Ruby, half a dozen Ruby gems. And what I saw over and over and over, as I sort of watched other maintainers and watched the larger community, is that maintainers would put, you know, hundreds or possibly even thousands of hours into a project. And they would get nothing out of it, aside from a little bit of exposure. You know, people now know that person as, oh, the testing guy, or the, you know, the database
guy,
the database gal who does this, you know, one thing. And but they don't make any money off of it. It's just something that they spend a lot of their spare time on. And that's why open source is so heavily trends toward younger people, sort of people in their 20s, because they have the free time to where they can afford to give this time to the community. Well, when I started working on Sidekick, I was 35 or so, and I had—
That's when you started.
That's when I started. So I'm 45 now. So it was 10 years ago. What was I getting at? Oh yeah. Well, I'm married with a kid, and so I don't have those nights and weekends that I can give so much. And so I said, I've got to find a way, if this project is really going to be long-term, I've got to find a way to make it my full-time job. And so that's when I started exploring, you know, how can I, sustainability and what does that look like? And sustainability for me is very simple. It just means money. Like, if I can't afford to live and work on this thing for 40 hours a week, then it's not sustainable. And so, you know, that sustainability looks like different things to different projects. Some people have Patreons and try to go sort of through the crowdfunding type, or maybe they'll do a Kickstarter where they'll get, you know, $50,000 one time, or you know, $100,000 to build this thing over the course of a year. But I went for more of a business approach where I decided to productize. And so my open source project is a product in itself that is valuable, that has features and functionality that works, and people are welcome to use it all around the world for free. And then I have mm-hmm. products where you can upgrade to more features. And so some of those features are gated. They are closed source. And, you know, the world cannot see those features and cannot use those features unless they pay me for access to them. So, and yeah. that's how I get to sustainability is I have over 1,000 customers now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a refreshingly simple approach. It's kind of, if you were an alien that came to planet Earth in 2020 and heard about it, you'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, you offer some valuable software for free. And then once folks are bought in and they want the kind of pro features and they pay for it, just like we pay for all sorts of things in this world. But it's actually a very unique approach among all open source. So again, I'm going to make sure to link to a lot of your previous interviews, because folks who haven't learned about you yet might not understand just kind of how successful this has worked out for you in terms of creating a space, like you were saying, to really work on the architecture and the project that you want, live the life that you want without having to make crazy trade-offs and sacrifices for the sake of open source. And I think it's important to point out that you still very much believe in open source and a lot of the ethos and the core values that we all share as web developers who like working in the open and working off of each other's work. You know, it's not one or the other.
Yeah, I another interesting thing about me is that my business is just me. It's solo, and I've elected to avoid hiring as long as possible. Mm-hmm. As I like to think of it, it's just another dependency. And if I'm going to, you know, espouse the mantra of simplify and keep your dependencies low, well, you know, having no employees means I have no management overhead. I have no admin overhead. Even things like benefits, I don't need because I'm not an employer. I'm just working on my own. And so my wife provides the healthcare benefits through her job. And I get a paycheck and whatever profits left at the end of the month. So it's a very simple business model. And it works well for me. But as I tell people, that doesn't mean it's going to work for you. I was able to productize Sidekick and Factory because they are pieces of application infrastructure that they're considered big pieces of infrastructure that are worthy of purchase. And so you can charge thousands of dollars a year for them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some libraries out there can't really be productized. Think of a library that does you know, the time zone data. How do you productize that? I'm not sure. But
now, do you think your background? You know, you said at one point you were managing like you know, half a dozen gems in the Ruby ecosystem, maybe more. And you naturally started falling into working on background jobs and Sidekick. Do you think that would have happened even if you had been working on a time zone parsing library? Basically, what I'm asking is like it. I think there's more to it than just, oh, you kind of ended up working on something that's critical. I feel like maybe what happened was because naturally, you know, you are good at software. You are good at exposing APIs that are easy to use, that are powerful, about thinking the right abstractions. And you naturally kind of move towards this very high impact project. It's a very high value, high impact project. So I'm just wondering if that was that deliberate, or do you think it was happening because you were already thinking entrepreneurially about how to sustain your open source work? Or is it really just a complete chance that happen to be working on this problem?
Yeah, well, the Sidekick project really represents an intersection of a bunch of the things that I love. I love the Ruby programming language. I love performance tuning. I love concurrency and multi-threading and sort of building that infrastructure. It's mm-hmm. really tricky, but it's sort of a fun mental exercise or puzzle to solve. And I had obviously had multiple years of experience doing Ruby open source before. So I sort of was in a good place to build this project. The one thing that I did recognize when I started the project, though, is that this was going to be a large, complex project. And if it got a lot of traction and became a success, it was going to burn me out very quickly unless I had some sort of sustainability aspect. And so that's why, as part of starting the Sidekick project, I publicly blogged about how, hey, this project is going to kill me unless I talk about finances and how to bring in money to make it sustainable for me to work on the project. What I want is the more people that use Sidekick, the more money I should bring in. That to me was a success.
Aligning the incentives as well.
That, yeah, exactly. That's the definition of success for this project is Sidekick succeeds and I succeed. And there's no better way than by charging people who use it. You, as you said, you align interests that way.
That's interesting. So you were able to recognize this before you even hit that burnout wave.
Oh yeah, because I saw other.
And you had already also been doing open source at this point. This wasn't your first year. This was like your 10th year of doing open source.
Correct. I had actually previously built the Memcached client for Ruby, and a company paid me to build that gem. And they paid me $3,000, and I probably put 3,000 hours into that gem.
I have been in a similar situation, yeah. And so you're like, $3,000 for open source, and then you realize 6 months later, what have I done?
You can do the math, but people who think I'm the smartest guy after hearing that story may realize that I'm a pretty dumb guy.
Well, it's, you know, part of why I wanted to bring this up and talk about it is because I do think, you know, the business and the marketing and the entrepreneurial aspects of software are important for, it's easy for us as programmers to compartmentalize and say, we want to focus on the performance tuning and the concurrency. And I'm a nerd, and I don't know how to talk business with anybody, but really at the end of the day, these problems you were seeing, it was coming from a place of wanting better software to exist in the world. And you knew, even if you had a vision for Sidekick and for the projects that you were working on, without sustainability, it didn't matter. All the best ideas in your head didn't matter because you had to figure out a way to finance bringing them to life.
Right.
So, yeah, it's really cool.
I heard I saw a Wikipedia page yesterday called Wicked Problem. And a wicked problem is defined as a problem that has no preset solution, and every single instance of a wicked problem has a completely different solution from every other wicked problem. And I think of open source sustainability as a wicked problem because there's no good solution for, or each project is going to have its own specific solution to its place in its ecosystem, and there's just no right answer, and it's hard to get people to support you in one way or another.
Do you think could one day be a layer, a marketplace, subscriptions built into GitHub, subscriptions based on downloads and usage that could actually solve the business side and make it something that, you know, like ads on YouTube, like folks creating content on YouTube can push a button and monetize their content, and they don't have to learn how to run a business like you have, basically.
Yeah. Well, there are several different systems that are trying to solve parts or aspects of this problem. You know, GitHub has the thing, the Stripe integration now, I believe.
Sponsors. Yeah, I think so. Yep.
So GitHub has sponsors. There's another startup called Tidelift, which is unfortunately VC-backed. So I don't think VC-backed anything is the solution to open source, unfortunately. Paying for the guys in suits to bank your way out of this problem is not tractable, I don't think. So we need more things like nonprofits, foundations, and that sort of thing, and sort of more like a stewardship sort of solution is what I think is probably more broadly effective.
Interesting.
But yeah, running a nonprofit, you know, Ruby has Ruby Central and what's the other one called? Ruby Together, which are nonprofits in the Ruby space that sort of manage and maintain some open source that is sort of core to the Ruby ecosystem.
Yep. Interesting. You know, one big difference between how you've talked about the business side of Sidekick and a lot of these sponsors and Patreon, you know, a lot of those are, they get to a point where you raise a certain amount of money. I mean, I know Evan Yu has done this for Vue.js, and I think he's doing pretty well for himself in the sense that it's not like he's just scraping by and having to make a martyr of himself to support Vue for the whole community. You know, he's actually able to be rewarded for the value he has created. But I think for a lot of folks, the Patreons of the world end up just being almost more like that, just scraping by, really barely justifying the work I'm doing. Whereas when you were speaking earlier about getting in a Sidekick, you wanted to set it up in a way that the better Sidekick does, the better you do financially. And I think that is I really believe in that as a good way to align incentives. And again, I don't think it's antithetical to open source values, but I think some people would be rubbed the wrong way from it. Do you think that having those incentives aligned between you and your customers how has that affected Sidekick, the code, the APIs, you know, and the actual library?
Yeah, well, obviously, my business model is to create feature packs that are closed source and that other people, you know, that open source users don't have access to unless they pay. So there are, so if someone wants to use those features and doesn't want to pay, then what they would then need to do is either build that feature themselves or to use a third-party gem or third-party package that implements that feature within Sidekick. And so you have things like, you know, cron jobs, for instance, is an enterprise feature that I provide. But a lot of people will integrate a Sidekick cron or another cron package where you just drop it into your gem file and now Sidekick supports cron jobs.
Gotcha.
And that's fine. They can do that. But again, that's something they have to manage themselves. They have to upgrade themselves. And then, of course, the question then becomes, what happens with the Sidekick cron maintainer?
Right.
So he's maintaining it for free and he's going to burn out and as it gets more successful. And now no one's maintaining that.
Right.
So again, you get the, I think it's called the free rider problem, where the more people that use a free thing, the worse it becomes for the person who's maintaining that thing. So, and that's why, you know, I charge a minimum for my feature pack, and that keeps me going because obviously it's my full-time job.
Right.
But yeah, that's the trade-off there. And so people are perfectly fine with you know, using an open source package instead of paying me, and that's their prerogative, but that's the trade-off they make.
Right. And again, kind of going back to your goal was to see this project be a sustainable one. And I think we don't really talk, because open source has its roots in you know, being free. I mean, whenever I talk about open source to people outside of tech and web, they're like, I don't understand. I literally don't understand. You're saying people work at night for free to make software that runs billion-dollar companies. Like, I don't get it. And so I just think because we are coming from within the industry, folks, you often see folks say things like, well, why don't you just add this yourself, or be the change you want to see and go fix the PR yourself, and all this kind of thing. And it's really not the difference between paying for something for X to exist and then doing X for free. It's really like the differences between paying for X to exist and X not existing in the world at all, even for folks who would be happy to pay for it because the maintainer has burned out and no one is going to support it, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And going back to Patreon, Patreon is another possible solution. But, you know, as you mentioned, it oftentimes just devolves into a tip jar. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So, you know, you may earn $5 here, $5 there. And it's quite common to see people pulling in $50 a month for their open source project, which, you know,
it's not going to change the game.
It's not going to move the needle at all.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I know so many people who work in open source, and I know they have really big ideas and visions for things that could exist. So I just wanted to make sure to surface that aspect of your work for people to hopefully encourage and inspire people to be thinking about this themselves, that they can do it. Again, you have a lot of blog posts where you're very detailed about your journey and what works and what didn't work, on your journey to monetizing Sidekick. So we'll make sure to link to your blog, and folks interested in the kind of this aspect of open source can be sure to read through those. Maybe just one more question I jotted down here, kind of going back to like the APIs and just your experience in open source. You know, we've also done open source for a couple of years now, and seeing what libraries get popular over the last few years, especially in front end JavaScript, you can kind of break down libraries like small, low-level tools versus kind of high-level batteries-included tools. And so I was just kind of curious to get your thoughts on how you think about, you know, what APIs you add to Sidekick and Factory when you say no. Was that something, a skill you had to learn to say no to people? How do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think the two broad sort of separate things I think about are libraries versus frameworks. So you talked about low level things. That would be a library where you're calling it. And then a framework is your bigger batteries included type thing where it calls you. So, right. So you provide plugins, you provide bits of code that the framework knows how to find and knows how to execute. And so, you know, the factory worker packages are designed to be a framework where you can plug in your application code and you boot up the worker and it knows how to call your application code to execute various jobs. And then the library aspect of factory would be the actual API that it provides. If, you know, when you're chattering with the server, you can create a library which knows how to talk that API. But when you're talking about integrating an application and executing application code associated with background jobs, then that's where the framework sort of aspect comes in, and the worker package also manages the concurrency and all that kind of stuff. So now as to whether or how I think of feature requests and that sort of thing, that's a good question. I don't have really a good answer for that. I mean, you know, the simple answer is it's always contextual, right? I mean, everything is contextual, and you have to make trade-offs, like considering the complexity that something might add to the system. You know, is this one little tiny feature going to add a bunch of complexity? I can give you an example. I saw yesterday that Rails and active job added jitter to retries. And so that is, if you spawn 1,000 jobs and all 1,000 fail, they won't retry all at the exact same millisecond and slam your system.
Right? I see.
So what it adds a little bit of jitter to that timing, so that Daggering when 1,000 fails, those 1,000 may retry over, say, 30 seconds rather than at the same millisecond. And so that makes it so that you're not just crushing your database with load with a high volume of jobs retrying. And so they added that notion of jitter, which is great. And Sidekick has had it for 5 or 6 years now. So, you know, it's built into Factory and Sidekick. No worries there. But it took them 2 years to implement this. And it's literally just a number. They're just calculating a number. And it took them 2 years. Not only that, but they have several config knobs associated with this number. And so instead of just simply adding it and saying, here's how we're going to do it, and this is it, we're not going to let anybody configure it. Now they've got a bunch of config knobs. They've added complexity to their system that it is probably unnecessary. How many people are actually going to want to tune this thing? Probably 1% or no percent. And so that's a good example where I would have said, no, we're not going to do any of those config knobs. I'm just going to implement it under the covers. You're not going to know anything about it. It's just going to work.
Simplest and version of it that solves the problem. And
exactly.
And yeah, going to work for... Yeah, 90. Probably even if it worked for 80%, it's still worth doing the simple version, or 70%. It's still worth right. doing the simple version until it becomes a big enough number.
Well, like I said, I implemented it probably 6 or 7 years ago now, but I've had literally zero requests to tune it. So
yeah, not worth delaying 2 years probably to allow this
that
to
what
be
you
configurable.
Will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So yeah. So definitely when it comes to this stuff, you know, your own taste and perspectives on software, you know, like you said, you are, you know, kind of some of the ways, things you believe about software, and keep getting rid of dependencies as much as possible. That's some of that stuff is going to come through in your projects and how you maintain them and how you evolve them over time. But at the same time, it's clear that you are in touch with kind of the needs of your customers to be able to identify feature sets that you can actually sell and that businesses find more than worthwhile to purchase. So there's a kind of a customer empathy that's important there as well.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, my systems are built on top of open source projects. I try to do everything in the open as much as possible. So if a customer emails me privately and says, I'm having this problem, more often than not, my only response is, hey, can you go open a GitHub issue? And that's because when I can do it out in the public, other people can see what's going on. They can chime in with their own opinions. But possibly the most important is there's a record of it now historically, where if someone else has that problem, they can go into the issues, they can search, and they can see this issue that somebody else had. And, oh, yeah, that's my issue too. And that's how you get self-service. And so that's how you scale a business of one. Is I would not be able to survive if I did everything privately, because everybody would be emailing me and I would spend all day answering emails. And so I try to direct my customers as much as possible to self-service through GitHub, looking through the wiki, looking through the issues, and finding their problem. Because more often than not, they're not the first person to run across some sort of problem.
Yeah. And would you say just that interaction with them on GitHub issues and forums is the main way that you figure out where the biggest pain points are, which might suggest what to work on next?
Absolutely, yeah. GitHub issues, by far, the number one way. You know, you want something in Sidekick or Factory, open an issue. And I'll typically respond within, you know, a business hour.
Right. Any parting advice for folks who are kind of interested in sustainable open source?
Good luck.
Again, I just want to make sure that listeners know that. I think you are happy with your situation right now. You know.
Oh, very much so. I mean, yeah. I'm quite open with my success. I mean, I'm well into the millions in terms of annual revenue. So this has been a life-changing, from a financial standpoint, it's been absolutely life-changing.
Yeah. And you're also able to do what you love doing, which is, you know, working on open source, working on software, helping people with their jobs. And so it's a much better spot than maintaining 10 gems and staying up at night closing issues. So
making a dollar an hour.
Awesome. Well, Mike, we'll be sure to let everyone know about Factory, where they can find it and where they can learn how to use it. Is the best spot just the project on basically contribsys/factory on GitHub?
That's it. Or the GitHub repo, either one.
Awesome.
Yep.
Excellent. All right, Mike, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and we really appreciate all the community work you've done, both in Rails and now in the larger kind of polyglot ecosystem. So really looking forward to seeing how Factory changes over the next coming years as well, and just following along with your work.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I appreciate the conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. All right, thanks. Bye-bye.